Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. I'm assuming since you have a lot of thoughts, you've seen the first three, right?
Yes, I sure have, yeah.
Okay, because we actually went back and watched the first two Sam Raimi films, like, on Sunday.
Yeah. Couldn't bring ourselves to watch the third.
Didn't really need to. I just wanted to get a feel for the Sam Raimi films because, you know, there's a lot of comparison to them. Mm-hmm. And it's been so long since I've seen them, I was just like, look, I can speculate or I can have this idea in my head of what they were like, but let me go back and actually look at them with this new lens. And I was very surprised at what I found.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. They should have, in my opinion, learned from the third Raimi film in this one about too many villains and and now they're going to, like, they're going to have a Sinister Six movie or something that's not even going to have Spider-Man in it. And it's like, what?
I would be really interested to see, anyway, we can talk about this later too.
Sure.
How do you have a movie without a hero?
I don't know that, unless I tell you the only, we can talk about it more later. I have a theory on it, but I don't know if I'm right. I probably am not. So,
let's see. I'm gonna say, I typically read, what J.R. Forresteros writes over at Normal Rogers.
Oh, sure.
He,
yeah.
He had this really long thing about what, Sony's probably going to do with this entire franchise, like movie by movie and how they're going to get there. And I was like, this is genius. I mean, I can't speak to the quality of how it turns out, but
yeah,
well, I was like, if I saw someone write this on a whiteboard, I was like, I can get behind that.
Yeah. But I haven't read that. JR is a friend of mine. He lives pretty close by. So that's cool that you read his stuff. He's a very smart guy. He just has so much good stuff to say.
Yeah. He's been on the show. He did, what did he do? We did American Hustle.
Oh, okay. I still haven't seen that. That's one I've been really wanting to see.
It's pretty good, but I'm in no rush to see it again.
Yeah. Okay. Well, cool.
So, I mean, so do you typically, like, rush out to the theater to, like, see stuff, like, right away, or is, like, movies something you rarely see?
You know what? It's becoming more and more rare because we have a 1-year-old now, and it's just harder and harder to get out to the theater and find a babysitter and all that. I do try, just because I'm such a comic book fan, I try to get to the comic book movies when they come out fairly quick. But I had to actually kind of work some things around to get to it this time. I actually ended up going to I had a free ticket to a matinee, so I found a sitter on last Friday and was able to clear my schedule, and I went and saw it. And I didn't have to pay any money, so I was like, you know what, even the worst movie, if it's free, it's worth going. So yeah.
But, go ahead.
No, I say I used to be more that way. I used to, like, try to, as before I was a parent, I used to try to get there as quick as I could, but it's a much more rare thing. So we watch a lot of streamed films, and and I'll get our library actually has a pretty good selection of DVDs, so a lot of times they will actually get, like, the movies that just came out fairly quickly after they released on DVD, and I can check those out for free from the library. So I try to stay up on them, but it's usually they've been on DVD by the time I see them.
Well, I would say this is probably one of the quickest turnarounds. I mean, and this podcast probably won't even go up for, like, a week just because of the schedule on how they're posted, but this is one of the quickest turnarounds we've actually recorded after movies aired. So I really appreciate you, making sure you had a chance to see it in that time frame.
Yeah,
we don't have any children, but, like, we had to sit down and have a conversation as a couple, and my wife has been very gracious. I was like, if I'm going to do a podcast on movies, then I have to see movies. And unfortunately, it's really great because Laura actually likes a lot of the things that I like. Like, you know, we typically go to a movie. And it's not always this way, but we'll go to a movie and it'll be like, hey, we're going to go see Captain America. And it'll be me, like, six guys and Laura. And they're like, oh, I can't believe you dragged your wife to see this. She's like,
and I'm like, yeah. Why am I at Pacific Rim? Ugh, yeah. That's awful.
This looks stupid. Stupidly awesome. You know, so I'm very fortunate that way. So you know, we.
So
have,
you weren't a fan of Guillermo del Toro's stab at Voltron or however it was.
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
I thought it was amazing.
It was a lot of fun. I really liked that one a lot. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No. Well, like I said, conversation, so it's all good.
Good stuff.
But yeah, so you know, we have to kind of like have a budget, and I have to be like, well, if I'm going to see a movie, I have to be podcasting about it because movies are expensive.
Yes, they are.
You know, or at least I have to do a write up on it or something. But that's one of the biggest canyons between Real World Theology coming out twice a month mm-hmm. and Real World Theology coming out like four times a month.
Yeah.
Because we could always, I mean, I could go see four movies a month. I mean, not all of them are going to be popular enough to really, I think, stimulate conversation or affect and drive culture. But, you know, it could be. But, like, you know, at the end of the day, I don't get paid to do this yet.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's the pipe dream of us podcasters everywhere. One day I'll make money on this.
I feel like making money podcasting is... like less of a chance than becoming like a recording artist these days, like an actual, like your livelihood comes from this, not like you played, you know, a show like this weekend.
Yeah.
But like your livelihood came from it. So,
oh yeah, I live that.
Yeah. I know.
For sure.
And I hope you'll tell people about that at the end of the show.
Yeah, definitely.
But do you have any questions or anything?
No, I don't think so. I'm raring to go, man. I'm excited. This is great. I've been a Spider-Man fan since I was a kid, and I've read lots of Spidey comics, and so I definitely am excited to get to talk about Spidey.
Well, that is excellent. Okay, well, then, Laura, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Remember to speak up.
Okay.
That's not even close to speaking up.
She got a little bit deeper, I think.
I mean, you would think that it would pick them up, but your googly eyes don't.
Aww. Like, what's the point?
So, Laura, if you're ready. Rick, if you're ready.
I am ready.
All right. Well, then I will start us. Maybe. Maybe. I will begin. Maybe. Maybe.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 25. I am your host, Fizz. On this episode of the podcast, we keep the superhero talk going by looking at the second installment in the Amazing Spider-Man universe. It certainly isn't quite the same quality as the Marvel Cinematic Universe, oddly enough, but it does feature Marvel's most popular and, to a certain degree, most relatable superhero. In this sequel, Spider-Man's responsibilities start to seriously affect Peter Parker, his alter ego's ability to function as a normal guy. From haunting visions of Gwen's father to never being anywhere he is supposed to be, especially on time, Peter struggles with... what his ever-growing responsibility in both lives needs to be. With his relationship with Gwen uncertain and Oscorp finding ways to create new villains, Peter Parker and Spider-Man may find that they are, though they are extraordinary, they both need help. Identity, tough love, living in the moment, responsibility, and the power of choice, we have a lot of ground to cover. So, with introducing this week's guest, I just want to say that I'm loving that on the show that we're getting more and more people involved in the conversation. Like, I guess I don't technically know wholly how some of the listeners feel, but I personally love the fact that I have someone new on this show almost every show now mm-hmm. because there's so many people out there who are interested in the kind of engaging culture in this way. And with that said, this week we have... returning to the show, fan favorite, based on my own, I'm a fan of the show, and I'm a fan of you, the Gwen Stacy to my Peter Parker,
aww.
Laura Fissel.
See? You had the clapping in the back.
That's right. Joining her is first-time guest, who hopefully won't go Green Goblin on us,
I'm the Norman Osborn of podcasting.
Well, I mean, I normally wouldn't say that, but from the Voices in My Head podcast, Rick Lee James. So welcome, Rick.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here and talk a little bit about Spidey tonight.
All right. Well, so we're going to start this off like we do most, and then we'll kind of have like a side follow-up. But the first question is, did you enjoy the movie? And like we do it on the show, anyone who's calling over Skype gets to go first. So, Rick, did you enjoy the movie?
I did and I didn't. I mean, it's weird to say that, but I there were parts that I really enjoyed, and I thought, oh, this is fun. And we can get more in depth about what I didn't in a few minutes here.
Yeah.
But it's hard. I've been thinking a lot about it because I've actually been kind of trying to like figure out, did I like this movie? Because I came home and I told my wife, I said, yeah, I probably will, you know, I'll probably watch it again or when it comes out. And then I'm thinking, I don't know. Maybe I will. Maybe they'll just like fast forward to certain parts I like because there's parts that were really good and parts that I just thought, oh man. So, let me just say, I think I liked it. I had an enjoyable time, and it beats changing diapers. You know, so I wasn't changing diapers while I watched it. So you know, if that's my litmus test or my bar that it comes up to, then sure, I liked it. Sure.
It seems like you set the bar so low. Well, I'll preface things with this. Typically on the show, from the very beginning, we have like a spoiler alert. We don't have like a no spoiler section and a spoiler section. If we're going to be talking about the themes, the narrative,
sure,
of the story, we're going to talk spoilers. So with that in mind, maybe without being really specific, like what parts could you give example of, maybe like an overview of some of things that you liked versus things that you didn't like?
I think the parts that I liked were, there was a couple parts where they were really faithful to some of the visions in the comic, and I've been a big fan of Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man comics, really probably since I was a kid. I got away from it for a while. I came back as an adult later in life and started collecting them again, and not only reading the new ones, but finding like back issues and things like that. So I'm pretty well versed in the entire Spider history, and so there were certain nods in the movie, specific things that happened, especially like the ending with Gwen Stacy, things like that, that I was like, oh wow, it's just like, you know, I'm getting to see on screen what I've read and what I've loved. But mm-hmm. then even within that, there were things that were so unfaithful to the story, which I really don't have a problem with, but I just felt like they've changed enough that it almost has taken the punch out of what made it so memorable in the original story. So mm-hmm. while there were some iconic type things that we saw on screen, such as the death of Gwen Stacy, you know, which I think is the worst kept secret in the world,
yeah,
as far as that goes. While that happened, even I was looking at the panel today of where it was drawn, and the circumstance is different. It's shown much differently in the movie. Even the way that she's caught seems to be different than how it is, you know, in the comic. And so I'm like, if you're going for iconic, you know, you've got her in the same outfit, you've got her, a lot of the details are right, but a whole lot of them are different, and even how she died, it's similar, but it's not quite there. So I don't know if that makes sense to say. I like where they were faithful, but I really struggled. And again, I don't struggle with them being unfaithful to a story if it's to tell a better story, but I mm-hmm. don't know that they necessarily changed things in the way that made the story better. So, yeah.
And there is a big difference between trying to tell a story through a comic or trying to tell a story, you know, just in a book
mm-hmm.
or trying to tell a visual, like, movie or even TV story. Like, all those mediums, you have to slightly change that. So it's understandable that
sure.
they change it. But then again, kind of like you're saying, I would agree that, you know, change it to make it better.
Right.
Change it to make it work. Don't change it just because you thought you had a better idea that you didn't sure. run by anybody first.
And one of my main things, and we could talk more about this later too, but one of the main things I really thought suffered was, you know, we talked about like Spider-Man 3 in the pre-show and how that film kind of suffered a bit because they're trying to pack too many villains in. And I felt like, you know, the character Harry should have been the main villain all along, and Electro to me was like Well, he was really kind of insignificant to the whole storyline because the whole movie was pointing to this one moment at the end, and we should have really been invested in this big bad villain that Harry became, and we sort of were because the actor was very engaging. I almost felt like he was the best part of the movie in some ways, but we didn't see enough of his progression as to why he became this villain that that ultimately does the big, what's supposed to stop your heart in the movie is kill Gwen Stacy, and we actually see him as the villain in like 2 minutes of screen time or something. You know, it's almost almost like the end of Spider-Man 3 where they, you know, they just like, oh yeah, and there's Venom too, you know, it kind of throw him in at the end of the movie like, oh, there was a second villain, where was he the whole movie, you know? So yeah,
well, Laura, did you enjoy the movie?
I feel pretty much exactly the same way, and there's a review link that you sent us before the show from Elijah Davidson from Real Spirituality, I think, is the site, but I feel pretty much how he described the movie. He basically goes through each part and says, I'd love to see a movie called The Amazing Aunt May, or The Amazing Gwen Stacy, or The Amazing Max Dillon, or basically all the different parts, that they were all good, but then, I don't know, it's kind of, I don't know about you guys, but when you're knitting a sweater, you knit like all the panels, like the sleeves and the front and the back, all of those look great, but then when they tried to seam them together, the seams were so ugly and loose, and that the whole thing, I felt like, didn't work together, but I like the pieces so much that I wish it could have been different. I wish it could have been seamed together a little bit better. The transitions could have been better. Yeah, I think back on, you know, on parts that I would... I tried to think back on parts in the movie and decide for myself what I... Okay, you're giving me hand gestures and I don't know what you're gesturing. What do you want me to do?
Talk this way.
Okay, I will talk this way.
I don't know why you're gazing longingly off into the distance.
I'm trying to visualize the movie. So I tried to think about, like, Electro and say, oh, I would just take him out of the film. But there were some scenes that he was in that I thought were really powerful. And so there's not necessarily a whole villain or a whole section that I would... that I hated, I guess. Maybe I just wish they weren't in there in the first place to make me like them. but anyway, yeah, there's a trailer. Well, pretty much any trailer I've seen, now that I've seen the movie, I look back at those trailers and think, that's not really what this movie is about. Or, like, where's Harry in that trailer? I mean, like, to me as a storyteller, like, who is... currently trying to encapsulate my own story into a couple of sentences in order to sell it to an agent, I don't even know how I would query this story because there's so many pieces. How do you distill that? Mm-hmm. And if you can't distill it into one or two sentences, then do you really have a strong story?
Well, and I think that when you put it that way, I think one of the faults with lots of the Spider-Man movies, and not that we've quite gotten this far yet, but what where you're going reminds me that I think, unfortunately, most of the Spider-Man films, the Sam Raimi and the new Mark Webb ones, they all have the same kind of query. They're all like, Peter Parker balances his life between superhero and regular guy while trying to overcome villains and maintain his relationships. That's like every Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
I guess so, but when I think about this latest installment, that's not the thing that I think about the most.
But that's what's going on.
I guess so, but it's but not like the primary... It's not at the forefront. Maybe if something that overarching had... Maybe that could have tied everything together, but it wasn't at the forefront any more than any other theme I felt was really at the forefront.
Well, and I think that's part of the problem. I don't think that should be... I don't think you should be able to get away with using the same query, basically, for five Spider-Man movies now. I think you should have specific focus, especially on a character that's as relatable as Peter Parker and, you know, him having to wrestle with Spider-Man. I think that's so relatable that you can do a lot of things with it. But they just kind of keep falling back into this one thing. But is there anything else that you want to say?
there's a lot I would like to say.
About did you enjoy the movie?
No, maybe not.
Okay. Well, it's funny, Rick, you basically started your did I like it exactly like I have mine written down. Because I put, well, I did, and I didn't.
Yeah.
I thought the movie did a couple things that, I mean, I really, really liked. Not just like I really liked, but I really, really liked. I mean, in general, I just really like Spider-Man now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I like how he acts when he's in the costume.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's more true to the Spider-Man that I knew and grew up with, even though I would be, you know, I would be far removed to say that I have thorough comic knowledge of him, like you do, Rick. But that's the one I remember. That's the one I fell in love with. That's why he was my favorite superhero for the longest time. But you take that and then you kind of put the other side of it, like the things they did badly, like I just. I mean, you guys have both kind of danced around it or basically said it. You know, I just didn't think the story developed, right? Like, right. They're trying to cram too much. Like, Sony is so focused on three movies down the road and putting things in to build up, like, Spider-Man 4 or, you know, Venom eventually or, you know, the Sinister Six based in Oscorp thing.
Yeah.
That had nothing to do with the central conflict in this movie.
Yeah.
That I don't understand why it was there, and I even commented on one review of it that I was kind of like, you know, maybe we'll look back after Spider-Man 3 comes out or Spider-Man 4 comes out and we'll watch 2 again and say, oh my gosh, that thing that, you know, that pointed to the thing all along, and it'll blow our minds or something. But right now it feels bloated and unnecessary. Like, I feel like the entire thing with Peter's, like, parents should have been in the first movie and not in this movie at all. While there were some scenes with Electro that I was kind of okay with, I could have done without Electro altogether, and I completely agree, Rick. I think they should have just focused on Peter and Harry and Spider-Man and Green Goblin. And if they would have done that and did what they did with Peter and Gwen, then I think this movie would have had the focus it needed, and the payoff would have even been better than I think it ended up working, how it ended up working. I mean, because I think it worked because of the chemistry between, you know, Garfield and Emma Stone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it could have been 10 times that if they would have not just thrown Green Goblin in there. Because actually, when we left the theater, I remember talking to Laura, and I was like, I feel like they could have done without Green Goblin. No, wait. Green Goblin was the thing that they needed to, you know, do what they were trying to do by the end of the film. So wait, so did they start with the idea that they wanted to kill Gwen Stacy and that shape Spider-Man and then realize, oh crap, we need Green Goblin? Or did they start with Electro? I mean, where did they start the story at?
Yeah. Well, and I just to interrupt you a second.
No.
I thought it was so weird that, like, because the Green Goblin in the comics, that, I mean, Harry was only the Green Goblin for a very short time in the actual Spider-Man comics. Everybody, if you ask a Spider-Man reader, knows the Green Goblin is Norman. Mm-hmm. And Norman showed up for his deathbed scene, you know?
Was it his deathbed?
Or was it? Yeah, exactly. And he he looked all green and everything. But I thought, this just, like, we really are not getting the Goblin, even, you know, to, like, it could have been such a powerful punch at the end of the film when the Goblin does that, but we spent so much time focusing on Electro, who, for whatever reason, I mean, he seemed almost like he was mentally handicapped or something, you know, this villain that, for whatever way they wrote him or how he was played, I just felt like, gosh, this villain is just not, and like the way they took him out was like, give him a whole bunch of power. It was like, well, he just took all the power. That was the thing that was giving him power. So we're going to kill him by giving him power. And it was like,
it's because of science.
It's the, because science, that's why. And a car battery will turn you into a magnet. And it was just like, so really what we should have, I agree with you totally. I was kind of excited about Electro because I like him. as a villain, but I like Jamie Foxx a lot. I like Electro. I didn't care for him at all in this film. But
well, let me say something and then pose the question.
Okay.
To me, I tried to really think about why Electro was in this film at all. And the only real, I mean, the only real purpose I can see is to prove that Oscorp is bad.
Yeah.
I mean, but I already know Oscorp is bad.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't need what happened to Peter's parents and Electro to show me that Oscorp's bad. Heck, just because of more or less the hinting from last movie, or from the original, from The Amazing Spider-Man, the first one, I could tell that Oscorp was not on the level. Heck, just because Norman Osborn was kind of, skeezy in his bed, I was like, obviously the head of Oscorp was not on the straight and narrow either.
Yeah.
I didn't need an entire villain just to show me that.
Yeah.
So, but that's as far as I could get. So can you think, why was Electro in this film at all?
When I thought about that question, the first thing that came to my mind is that they needed something to be distracting Peter that he was preoccupied with, that the battle that he thinks is the greatest battle he's fighting while his friendship with Harry is turning sour. I mean, because that thing was happening so gradually, because Harry's getting sick gradually and then finding out things about his father gradually. And if Electro's not there, what is Peter doing? They could have had him just solving normal everyday crime in the city.
Just go back to the comics where he's just stopping bank robbers all the time.
There you go.
All superheroes do.
If they had done that, would that have been compelling enough while we're, watching this other thing slowly develop? I don't know. But that's what came to my mind, is that it was something that is preoccupying him and his mind and keeping him busy or, whatever. Is like an example of what his life is like as, Spider-Man, Peter Parker, trying to balance the two.
Yeah. And I think he was there, honestly. This may be just too simplistic, but I think he was a way to give them a big special effects extravaganza. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, we can make this seem really big and menacing. We'll use Electro. Or I don't know why he didn't turn into Eel Man, and he fell in that tank of eels. I was like, well, he's getting bit by eels. I guess he's going to turn into the electric eel or something.
Because he would have been useless like Aquaman.
Yeah, in the comics, he's actually a lineman working for an electric company, and he gets hit by lightning, and that somehow transforms him. So I guess they needed something different than that. But I think it's, again, I think it is probably somewhat you said about Oscorp is bad. But, again, we didn't need that. I'm afraid that every single thing in the movie from now on and from the beginning are going to revolve around Oscorp causing them all, and because we saw Dr. Octopus's arms, and we saw the Vulture's wings, and we saw, everything is an Oscorp. So I'm like, so are we just going to say that the only source of evil in the world is Oscorp?
Yes.
And couldn't Spidey just figure this out and be like, okay, we need to just shut down Oscorp? And we'll, because it was like, I don't know. In the comics, at least, there's a diversity. I thought, what if Harry, instead of randomly crawling to the goblin suit, crawled over and became Dr. Octopus instead,
Better movie.
Yeah, exactly. Because that was almost, and I know they showed the suit beforehand, so that was coming, but I was like, he's in the hall of suits, he could have become, so basically.
Why did he choose this one?
Yeah, basically all these supervillains are already created by Oscorp. They're all in, they're all in their designated booth. it's like we're just waiting our turn to go attack Spider-Man,
Well, and that's how, like I said, I feel like almost every good thing had the bad thing attached to it, or vice versa.
Yeah.
And I'll get to that later. But I think one of the things that I think they really missed on, to kind of shift gears here, is when they had a good thing or a good idea started with this whole relationship between Peter and Harry.
Yeah.
For some of the things that I wasn't on board with their conversations and stuff, I did feel like there was some believability to their friendship reunited.
Yeah.
And I felt like there could have been a lot of tension there. And I think they missed a good moment, because something that I felt like just kind of got glossed over was the fact that because Peter, as Spider-Man, you know, he cared for Harry, and he knew what giving him his blood would do. He had to say no to Harry. And this is like one of the most loving things a friend can do for another friend. And it just kind of, it was just, you know, just a thing that they did. So he'd throw a tantrum and go turn into the Green Goblin.
Yeah.
And I really felt that could have been more of a conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. The history of Harry in the comics too is, you know, he was always a bully to Peter all throughout their young lives and didn't become a friend until way later on in the story. Flash Thompson also, you know, always picked on Peter, and eventually they became friends. It's kind of like you grew up and came through that. But I just thought it was interesting because it felt like to me they were just trying to fit that relationship into the Sam Raimi movies. You know, like, because in that film, Harry and Peter have always been good friends, you know, but that's really not the case in the comics. It's always a very strained, tenuous relationship. So again, it's like, I feel like, wow, you could have maybe done that storyline too, you know, where Harry was one of them picking on Peter in the beginning. And that would kind of give you the idea that, to me, it was like, maybe there was a friendship, but Harry's kind of a spoiled jerk, you know? And there's
kind of.
I mean, really, he is. And in the comics, that was always his thing. He's a spoiled rich kid. He's dumb. He doesn't care about anything, you know, scientific. And he just kind of is a spoiled rich kid all throughout. And I just really felt like for some reason, they're still just wanting to retread ground that you know, Sony did with the first Spider-Man films. And I think it would have been interesting to, you know, in the first Amazing Spider-Man film, we had Flash Thompson who was picking on Peter, but then after the uncle died, very true to Flash in the comics, Flash comes up to actually console Peter because you start seeing, oh, there is some humanity inside of this jerk, you know? And I kind of wish we would have, obviously you can only do so much in a film, but I kind of wish we would have got that dynamic with that relationship, because all Peter ever says in this film was like, oh, you were so good to me and you were such a good friend and so close and helped me through such a hard time and I'm here to help you now. And I guess that works for the story, but I think you could have really, again, leave Electro out and focus on this complex relationship between those two people, and I think you'd have a whole lot of story going on there. But that's just my take on it. But.
No, I wouldn't disagree with that.
I have a hard time thinking about what the main theme is of this movie, because there are so many fragments here and there that I think aren't fully developed enough that there's a clear message. But one thing that I found interesting that seemed like a common thread through the film is this idea that the people in our lives shape who we are, and their choices shape our choices, and our choices shape other people. And the thing that I saw just a glimmer of with like Harry and his father, and then things that Peter was discovering about his father, is that idea of like legacy and fate versus choice. And I mean, Harry seemed to follow pretty clearly the path that his father had already blazed for him, the trail he'd already blazed for him. And for whatever reason, even though he didn't know him very long, Peter was finding himself with the same values and morals as his father. So it would have been really interesting, I think, to see that comparison, you know, like what makes one person turn down a path where they destroy and another person choose the path of life and hope. You know, is it, anyway, I would have really liked to have seen that develop.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, it's because Harry didn't listen to Gwen's graduation speech.
That's the missing factor.
That honestly, other than my conversion as a Christian, that speech is what really changed my life. I'd be honest. That is what we were supposed to take from that, right? Like it changes everything. So yeah.
Well, I mean, that was the thing. Harry himself, like, he didn't seem to have any love or really any pity for his father, Norman. But then he found out he was dying, and suddenly he couldn't cruise through life anymore.
Yeah.
Like, he kind of became a jerk once he realized his time was fleeting, and instead of using his time to do the most he could, he spent trying to figure out how he could buy life. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, Gwen gives this speech, and while admittingly it's pretty kind of nihilistic at times, or it kind of has like a nihilistic message of like seize the day, you know, do good while you can kind of thing. It does really focus on the fact that, like, we're not here forever.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do with that time? And more so than Spider-Man or Peter Parker, you know, however you want to define his decisions at any given time, Gwen is, I think, the embodiment of this.
Yeah.
Gwen is... one of the things I love about this movie is Gwen's character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Especially when we went back and watched the first... We watched Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2 and saw Mary Jane's character.
Yeah, she looks like a paper doll next to Gwen Stacy.
Yeah, she has almost no substance. And,
yeah.
And that isn't anything, I think, even to do with the actress. It's just how she was written. In the first one, she's whimsical. She doesn't know what she wants. She's basically always a damsel in distress.
Yeah.
She really doesn't bring anything. I hate
to trying not to be harsh.
Yeah,
but.
I hate to use absolute, but I really feel like she doesn't really bring anything that makes Peter or Spider-Man better.
Right.
Except for his longing for something that he's wanted.
Yeah.
Now, Gwen, on the other hand, in the new movie, she's like, to a certain degree, independent. She's, you know, she's not just smart. She's like valedictorian smart. She's got an internship at this super huge, really smart bio lab, you know, at Oscorp. She, you know, and not only that, but she's like, look, this is my view on life. Mm-hmm. I have to do something while I'm here. You know, my time is fleeting. I think she even, I don't think I have the quote, but, you know, it's basically like, she says, I know we all think we're immortal. We're supposed to feel that way. The future is and should be for us, but what makes life valuable is that it doesn't last forever. What makes it precious is that it ends. And while that's kind of a corruption of what I think we as Christians believe,
yeah,
that it's still something that she's faithful to, and her strict belief in the words that are coming out of her mouth is what changes Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And what affects him and shapes him.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. She was one of the bright points of the film, I thought, in this movie, for sure. As well as, I think his name's Dane DeHaan, who played Harry.
Yeah.
I thought he was fantastic. I mean, I thought, gosh, he should have played Peter Parker, you know? I felt like the supporting roles were great, and both Harry and Emma Stone's Gwen Stacy character.
Sally Field, I think, is an amazing Aunt May.
Yeah, yeah, and I just really felt like, oh, man, I'm going to miss Gwen Stacy in these films. Mm-hmm. Because I did admire kind of more who she was. And mm-hmm. in some ways, she was the stronger character of all of them. Because, like, even to the point where, Peter, I break up with you. You know, like, she's mm-hmm. she was willing, where Peter wasn't, to make the hard decisions. You know, I'm tired of this. I'm going to cut it off. You know, mm-hmm. again, life is only so long, and I'm not going to live it this way. And Peter never ever commits. Like, he's just so wishy-washy with, like, I guess I would say, he shows love, but he doesn't show agape love in the way that Gwen does. Because if agape is actually selfless and doing what is best for the other, you know, like, she has a much better concept of, okay, if we can't be together, then it's going to be hard for us to be friends, so I'm going to go far away, you know. Mm-hmm. And Peter just,
which is the most loving thing to do,
right? Exactly. And Peter just never gets that. It's just almost cruel, because, you know, we've probably all, anybody listening has probably experienced that, you know, unrequited love that just won't go away, you know. And mm-hmm. it's like, I love you, no, go away, I love you, go away, you know. And it's almost like Peter does that, you know, through the last film and through this one, I know they kind of had to do that to get them back together, but I really felt like, gosh, she almost had the strength of character that nobody else in the film had.
Well, and to a certain degree, I feel like I've had this in my own life because even though I'm not Spider-Man...
You're not?
If I was, would I tell you?
Probably not, yeah.
I'm out.
I'm out. Well, you know, like, Gwen didn't have her father showing up and haunting her, you know?
Right.
I mean, this is very similar to when I wanted to start dating Laura, and anytime I'd want to go date her, I'd have this image of her father saying, you know, you don't bring her into this. but, you know, eventually we decided, and hopefully, you know, Laura doesn't die at the hands of one of my supervillains. But, you know, you're like having to overcome that, like, it's not like he's making a necessarily a bad moral decision, you know?
Yeah.
He's trying to respect the wishes of the father.
Sure.
And he understands that he's wrestling with something, but I think the thing that Gwen gets right that he doesn't is that sometimes our actions have consequences.
Yeah.
But sometimes the chance of those consequences is worth it.
Hmm.
You know, I think fear often leads us to hesitate or, you know, like, oh man, I would do this thing if it just wasn't for, you know, this other thing that might happen. You know, we're only on this planet for a very short amount of time. And if given, I don't necessarily, you know, trying to infuse too much, theology into the film. Obviously, I don't think Peter Parker had a call from God necessarily to be Spider-Man.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But like in our lives, if we feel like we're supposed to do something or we're called or we're created to do something and we let fear stand in that way just because we might get hurt or something might not turn out the way we want it or it might not always be easy. I mean, that's us not doing what we were created to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I understand that fear that Peter has in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it would have been really compelling too. It would have drawn a firmer line in the sand if, on the one hand, you have Gwen saying, "I love Peter Parker more than I love Spider-Man. I want to be with you despite the consequences," and then you have Peter saying, "I can't do this. I'm too scared of losing you, and it's not right for me to put you in danger." But Peter isn't stalwart in that belief. Like, he, even though he respects her wishes or whatever and stays away from her for a year, he stalks her. He
yeah.
kisses her when he runs into her. He, you know, just acts like a lovesick puppy dog
yeah.
instead of saying, "I made this choice. It's dangerous for her. I'm done," you know?
Yeah.
And then at the end, makes the total opposite choice that he, you know, made in that rushed scene outside the restaurant.
Sure.
And says, "I'm going to follow you to England," you know? And
we got crime in England.
Yeah, so he still didn't, you know, he was still really wishy-washy. I wish that, I mean, maybe it's supposed to be that way. Maybe it's one of his flaws is that he is so in love that he can't bring himself to make that hard choice that Gwen made. But yeah, he... It would have been really noble
yeah.
if he was going to stay away from her for her safety. It could have been very noble, you know, but
yeah.
he didn't really make that choice.
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting to me. I mean, I was really glad, as we're talking about this, I was really glad. I'm just thinking, like, it seems like almost every second superhero movie, whether it's Spider-Man or Iron Man or whatever, like the original Raimi films were like this. Superman 2 was like this. The hero always goes through this time of, "I don't want to be the hero anymore. You know, I want mm-hmm. something else." And it's almost like they replace that with, "I don't want to date them anymore." You know, it's like that was – so in some ways, at first I was like, you know, I thought we missed that. I was going to be like, "Oh, awesome. At least we didn't have to carry out that old trope again." And then I was like, but I guess we kind of did, because we did it instead of like, "I don't want to be a hero." It's like, "I can't date them."
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, but to a certain degree, he's still doing that because
yeah.
he knows that if he decides Gwen, in his mind, he knows that he's probably got to stop
yeah.
being something that's a big part of him.
Yeah, definitely.
And so even though it's not stated kind of like it was in yeah. Spider-Man 2, when he starts to magically lose his powers.
Yeah.
When he's not really into it.
Yeah.
for all the sense that makes.
Yeah. It was psychosomatic.
It's on his head.
I don't know. I felt like that was actually pretty strong and compelling in the second, in Spider-Man 2, as opposed to Amazing Spider-Man 2. He had to make the choice, even so much as flinging himself off a building, not knowing if he was going to be able to shoot webs, because he's making the choice to be Spider-Man, you know? I thought that was a good way to show how difficult a choice that was to make. And, you know, if that is the same theme that's going on in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, I didn't really pick up on that so much.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have too much... it's interesting. I was trying to think back about how well those Raimi films hold up, and I think parts of them work really well and parts of them don't. But... Two is definitely my favorite of all those, and that was a good part where he had to decide if he's going to be Spider-Man. But again, it was kind of like, because like you said, he wasn't into it. He lost his powers or whatever. I was like, I'm not sure how that works, because all of a sudden he's got him back again. And so I'll say this: I'm glad we didn't have something like that in this film, but I did feel like. I'll tell you what I'd like to see in a superhero film is almost one reason I think Iron Man was so appealing and why some of these comics are actually appealing to people is they aren't all trying to be Batman. And to a certain extent, like there actually are comics where heroes enjoy being heroes, you know, and they actually are liking it. And there is a lot in Peter Parker's life that, he is always worrying about his aunt. He is always worrying about if, his being Spider-Man is going to hurt the people he loves. He's always got to be very careful. But they did try, at least in this film, to show some of the joy that Spider-Man has, you know, of being Spider-Man. I mean, from the very first time we see him, he's like falling through the sky and he's having so much fun. And there is a sense in which I'd like to see them really explore that side of the hero. He's always so tortured in all these films, but there actually are like storylines where he's not tortured. I do feel like it's some of the influence of the success of like the Christopher Nolan films, which with Batman, which were just incredible. I love those films. But that's Batman, and he is that dark, and he is that, you know, brooding and hard. And it's like, I'd love to see just like, because Spider-Man is all about quips and he's all about jokes, and even on his worst day he's always got like he's wisecracking some criminal and stuff, and they did a little bit more of that in this film than they have in some of the other ones. But I would have really liked to have seen them. I think for me it would have worked to see like Spider-Man really enjoying being Spider-Man and not struggling so much all the way through this film with whether he was going to be with Gwen. And then the punch of the film being like, what if we had like this like almost like, I'm loving being a hero, this is awesome, the fights happen, and then at the end there's this big consequence that we didn't see coming, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Bam, all of a sudden, because of his choices of doing this, someone he loved got hurt. And maybe it would have put some more punch into like what was going on in this film, like if we would have seen a little more of that joy throughout rather than the constant like, oh, I really want to be with you. Oh, I really want to be with you, know, but I can't because you'll get hurt, or I can't because Jedi, your father, is always behind you, you know.
Making that face. Yeah,
but I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense to you guys, but I really feel like that kind of thing would have like really put a lump in our throat at the end. Be like, oh, my gosh, like. There are consequences. It's one of the reasons that like Breaking Bad worked so well as a show. I don't know how much of that you guys have seen, but like that show is all about there's a consequence to every action, even when they think they're having a fantastic time. And I would like to see just a little bit lighter of a Spider-Man film and make those punchy parts where they want us to have our heart stop really count. And I don't know if that makes sense, but.
Yeah. No,
well, I think maybe we got that at the end of this film. Like, once he gets kind of that pep talk from Gwen, I mean, given he's always going to carry that that piece of Gwen with him.
Mm-hmm.
But when, you know, when she's like, you know, there'll be days when you feel all alone and that's when hope is needed most. I think he kind of embraces that at the end, and he realizes that He becomes completely quirky. He loves what he does. Mm-hmm. Does he understands why he is? He's fully at peace with his identity, and he jumps to fight the rhino. And I feel like the next film can be like that.
Yeah.
He'll obviously have a hard time kind of moving on from Gwen, but you know right now he's in, or at least it seems like he should be fully embracing Spider-Man. He shouldn't be wrestling with that anymore. Because he's maybe learned that lesson,
yeah,
and can move on.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the major conflict is in the next one if they don't go that route.
Yeah,
I almost feel like I did feel a little bit of what you're saying, Rick, about. I did feel the impact of Gwen's death really hard, like. I didn't love the movie. I didn't hate the movie. But when I went away, I couldn't stop thinking about that scene and how depressing it was.
Yeah, because she was the hero.
And and even as I saw her falling, I haven't read any of the comics, but a long time ago, Mikey had told me, even before I think The Amazing Spider-Man came out,
sure.
You had told me that his original love interest was Gwen Stacy and that she died and she'd snapped her neck or whatever. Mm. And so I'm watching her falling and his net reaching out for her like a hand. And I'm thinking, they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. Are they going to do it?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I said something that I may not be able to say on the podcast in the movie when it happened, just because it was such a visceral reaction, you know, when her head snaps back. And, and I think I felt it really hard because of the scene when he like writes, I love you in the bridge. And then they are up on that ridiculously high place, yeah, having no fear of heights, and saying, all right, fine, we're going to try to do this. We're going to choose to be together. You know, we're going to choose happiness. We're going to choose life. And then a few minutes, you know, not very long later, she's gone. And I think I felt that the impact pretty hard because it was like, well, what was the point of even choosing that? You know?
Yeah.
Like sometimes it feels like choosing happiness in the face of impending doom is pointless,
yeah,
you know, which I guess is what Gwen's speech is trying to pull Peter back from.
Yeah,
that it's in the darkest, you know, what she say, we have to be bigger than our suffering, we have to be better than our suffering.
Yeah,
well, but I felt that pretty hard.
I'll be honest, I mean, I felt it really hard too. I wasn't trying to say it wasn't well done. I think it could have been even more like powerful, but they did kind of turn it around in a big way for me when that happened, because you were so invested in Gwen. But I'll tell you something that I really, it's the same thing in the comics as it is in the film, as it is in life. When she dies, there's not a death speech. Like, oh, Peter, you must remember to not, you know, you know, because we're so used to that, because in film so often we can't even allow death to be final like it is in real life. You know, like when people in real life rarely get to make that final, take care of your aunt, Peter, you know, or whatever, whatever. Yeah. It's usually just like this, oh no, it's over. And that was one thing that I think made us feel it so strong in this film.
You get to say goodbye.
Yeah, in the comics, and I think it's definitely implied in the film in the same way. One thing I liked about this was, I mean, it's implied that Peter killed her, because, she would have died anyway, but at the same time, it's like the force of her being caught by his web, it like snapped her, you know? It was, and so, to an extent, it was like, she's gone, there's no goodbye, I did this, you know? Mm-hmm. And he both literally and figuratively killed her, you know, because his villains killed her, the consequences of his choices killed her, but also he actually, if he hadn't caught her, she would have died anyway, but again, it was his web catching her that snapped her neck or whatever it was that did there, because obviously she didn't hit the ground, but something would have had to really have you know, broken in her for that to happen. So that's been long debated in the comic world, is did Peter actually kill Gwen, you know? And And in the comics, you know, she's falling towards a river, you know, and they're saying, like, what if he hadn't caught her? Maybe she would have been okay. Huh. She would have just landed in the water, you know. Huh. Which, that scene where it sets up where he does the I love you and they're standing on the big bridge there in New York, that's the scene in the comic where she dies, you know. Mm. And so they weren't inside of a building or anything. So all that is to say, yeah, it was a really powerful death scene for sure, and it really did stick with you.
Does he say, I've seen pictures of that page from the comic, like, on the internet the last few days.
Uh-huh.
But does Peter say in the movie, like, over her body, like, I saved you, but I saved you? Because I thought I saw that, like, in the comic where he says.
I'd have to look that up again. I can't remember what he says, but whether it says it or not, it's definitely implied. Because he's like, it seems like, yeah, I caught you, you know, like before he realizes she's dead. I could probably find it fairly quick online if I look, but yeah.
I thought I saw the panel too, and he said something smart, like, not only am I the best looking, but.
Yeah, but my web.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, let's see, I've got it right here. I've got to. Spider powers, I love you. Not only am I the most dashing hero on two legs, and then he finds out she's dead, you know, right after that. So yeah, he does think he's saved her, but nope, sorry.
Well, I'll say one of the things that really, I guess, made the death stick with me is that even though I know, you know, Peter's going to blame himself for it to some degree, and well, obviously he does blame himself for it, because that's why we see, like, the seasons change and him standing there, obviously very remorseful and regretful of her passing. But I think the difference in the comic and in this that I actually like is that I don't think it necessarily is, you know, it's not, in my opinion, it's not Peter's fault, or, well, it's not Spider-Man's fault. I think it's Gwen's choice.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons, one of the things I really think they did right was Gwen in this movie, because, like I said, she's not like Mary Jane in the first trilogy. She's not, like, always helpless.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was no reason for her to even be there.
Mm-hmm.
Hypothetically, if she would have been, like, Mary Jane's character. But she's like, I know how to do this. I'm smart. I'm capable. I completely understand the decision that I'm making right now, and that it will have consequences. But I realize by not making this decision, there's also consequences. And she, to a certain degree, puts herself in this situation.
Yeah.
So to me, instead of Peter being the only person who risks in this relationship, both of them are risking in the relationship. And I think that's why it hurts so bad to have that relationship end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it, you know, it wasn't like him pining after her. Like, they were pining after each other, and they were willing.
It's real loss.
Yeah, and
he's really
real
lost something from his life with her absence. It's not just something that can be easily replaced. Like you were saying, Mary Jane doesn't seem to, you know, add anything necessarily to him or change him in any way, but Gwen does.
Yeah, or at least the Mary Jane from the first trilogy.
Right, right.
Sure,
I can't imagine them going through and adding Mary Jane later in this. This amazing universe, and not giving her probably a little more substance than they gave what Kirsten Dunst in the, the first one.
Well, Gwen wasn't like that in the comics, was she? She's not like the Emma Stone version.
No, not at all. Matter of fact, she's kind of not very likable in the comics, and in a lot of them, she's sort of this nagging girlfriend. She never, I don't think she ever realizes that Peter is Spider-Man before she dies, which is kind of interesting. And when she does die at the end of that issue, or maybe it's the following issue, it's you know, after he has gone after the Goblin, it's Mary Jane who comforts him. Because she's been present the whole time. There's almost been like this Archie, Veronica, and Betty relationship between Mary Jane and Peter and Gwen Stacy. So I thought they were going to maybe introduce Mary Jane as the friend that was going to be comforting him in this one, because it would be interesting to see how they bring her in. But she definitely has – Mary Jane has a lot more substance in the original stories, and is – among fanboys – liked a lot better than Gwen Stacy as far as a love interest for Peter. So that's why it was kind of a disappointment in the films that you didn't really get to see the Mary Jane that's in the comics.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, too, because there was a lot of stories before the movie came out about how Shailene Woodley, the lead from Divergent, was cast as Mary Jane and actually had a scene filmed for Amazing Spider-Man 2 that was eventually cut in the final cut, cast as Mary Jane. And I'm curious now to see if they want to introduce her differently or if the only reason they cut her was because she decided that she didn't want to be in like the Amazing franchise and try to handle the Divergent franchise.
Yeah, two big ones.
Yeah, I'm hoping that's not the case, because I like her as an actress, and I think she has the chops to kind of like portray a character that has some depth, even with little material to work with. I guess we'll see one way or the other, but I'm really hoping that I did want to see Mary Jane there.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted her to be established, not just kind of come in at the end being like, okay, a year later, Spider-Man still fighting crime.
Yeah.
And hey, I just happened to run into Mary Jane and I fall in love.
Right.
I think it would have been a lot better if she would have been there all along. But then again, they would have had to make Gwen different. Ah, so many choices.
I don't know. I really think they had space in this movie for one more storyline.
That's right. Yeah. We could just go ahead and push this to 2 hours or four hours, had an intermission.
Yeah.
get the full price.
It's the mad world of superhero movies with just every star in the world.
Dude, if Marvel or Disney ever finds a way to buy all of Marvel's properties back, that's what it'll be.
Yeah.
Like, everyone will eventually be in the Avengers, you know?
Yeah.
It'll be amazing, because I'm sure Joss Whedon will find a way to do it.
I'm not sure if there's a third one and Mary Jane shows up, I don't know how they can have him fall in love with somebody else without addressing the fear that you have to carry into that situation from, like, the baggage you have from your previous relationship. And, you know, we've been talking tonight about how we hope that they don't dwell too long on that same angst.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, just in general, how do you have the courage to love again after something so painful? I don't know. I don't know how he could fall in love with somebody else.
Unless they were there all along and you're not having to re-explain that conflict to them.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, and again, I hate to keep going back to the comics, but, you know, Mary Jane is referred to for a really long time in the comics, and Peter doesn't want to meet her because it's somebody his aunt's trying to set him up with. And she's like, oh, she's the sweetest girl, you're going to love her. And he's just always thinking in thought bubbles, she must be a dog if my aunt, you know, like she can't be. So there's actually a lot of issues where Mary Jane is only mentioned, or we only like see a shadow of her, or, you know, she just stopped by, but we didn't actually get to see her face. Peter's not here, well, I'll come back another time. You know, they never meet. And then when they finally do meet, her famous line is, you hit the jackpot, Tiger. They open the door and he's like, whoa. So maybe they'll do something like that where it's this kind of like he's trying to avoid it, and then all of a sudden, you know, the old movie love at first sight thing hits or something. But
that could be interesting.
But they could make it work maybe like that, I wonder.
Well, he just has to be like, come on, Aunt May, why didn't you tell me she was a smoking hot redhead?
Yeah, and
that's a given.
If I remember right, that's kind of how Stan Lee wrote it, too, because she was just this party girl in the comics, and she just, I mean, it was really like she was stringing Peter along and stuff, and sort of like the one you can't have is the one you really want, you know, throughout that. So anyway, that's... I guess we're all in agreement. We liked Emma Stone's portrayal of Gwen, though. It was really a good one.
Well, like you said, but outside of some of the qualms that I have with her graduation speech, or how it almost gives her like a death monologue.
Uh huh.
But then, to be fair, even Jesus got a death monologue.
Yeah.
So, you know, but besides some of the nihilism there, you know, about like this kind of life is all we have.
Mm-hmm.
That I really like her character portrayal, and I think it's finally a character that we can look up to. And to a certain degree, I think she is the hero of Amazing mm-hmm. Spider-Man 2,
mm-hmm.
Even though she can't web sling, which is the thing, because I think ultimately, even though in the new Amazing Spider-Man series, they find ways to say, with great power comes great responsibility, without saying, with great power comes great responsibility.
Right.
Yeah.
I think more so than Spider-Man or Peter Parker, I think Gwen embodies that. You know, she can't shoot webs, she can't, you know, jump off buildings or yada 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 or lift cars. It doesn't matter. Like, with all the power that she's been given, with, you know, her brains and her station, and just her abilities, she uses all those things to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, hopefully something that, even though she's gone now, will, like I said, Peter will be able to carry that piece of her with her and let mm-hmm. that change him forever.
Right.
Well, we've kind of come to a pseudo lull. There's some other things we could have mentioned. I mean, you know, there were some things there with Electro that we probably could have gotten into.
Oh yeah,
identity and stuff. But I want to move to a before we do our come on moments and our favorite moments, I want to do a listener question segment.
Okay.
Oh.
Because I posed the question out there. I said that we would be recording our next episode on Spider-Man. Or The Amazing Spider-Man 2, and asked if anyone had any things that they wanted us to hear us talk about, or, you know, just topics to bring up. And Joshua Crabb was wondering, why can't both sequels produce the quality of the first movie, I guess, in their respective trilogies? Mm-hmm. And he's talking about, you know, in his opinion, the, you know, Spider-Man 2 didn't live up to kind of what Spider-Man 1 was promising. And from what he's heard, and kind of what we're saying, you know, this Amazing Spider-Man 2 isn't really living up to what we were kind of promised yeah. in The Amazing Spider-Man. Do you find that... Well, I mean, I guess we've already said that Spider-Man 2 was kind of critically lauded as the best Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how would you address that question? Do you think that Spider-Man 2 or The Amazing Spider-Man 2 didn't live up to the first Amazing Spider-Man?
Do I go first?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I don't... I really actually like Spider-Man 2, the Sam Raimi one. I thought that was the strongest of the films. I definitely have a few problems with it here and there, but for the most part, I felt like that one really got the heart of what Spider-Man was. And I thought, like, finally, you know, we got a real comic book movie, you know, and the things that I love about the comics are in this film. And this one, I think there's a problem, and maybe the reason that these sequels don't work, part of it is you have this history in comics that you almost have to know something about in order to be excited about it in the first place, you know, because I don't know how many friends I've got that aren't into comics like I am, and they're like, you're going to see a superhero movie, you know? and until The Avengers, which seemed to have sucked everybody in, it was all kind of that way. So you've got this real problem where comic book fanboys are some of the most unforgiving people on the planet, you know, because I mean, we just like, that's not how it happened in the comic, you know, and you've heard me, you know, a half a million times tonight already say, like the comic says, you know, but I actually don't mind them changing some of it in the film. But I think you have this problem of you're trying to balance what all the fans already know and love, something that's so widely done, and while at the same time you're trying to communicate something to an audience that knows absolutely nothing about these characters, mm-hmm. and you're trying to fit them into a world. And it's one reason why I personally had so much problem with the second Hobbit film that came out with Peter Jackson, because it went so far away from the book, you know, that it was like trying to create Peter Jackson's vision and world for it, rather than, you know, something that in literature has been so beloved for so long. So I think that might be a reason that these other movies that follow the first one, I think they put all their eggs in one basket in that first one a lot of times, and they're trying to make it as good as they can. And it is similar to, you know, being a musician myself. It's like you have all the time in the world to make your first album. That second one, you have like a year, you know, and you just don't have the time to dwell on it like you once did. So I think a lot of it is you got a rush to get something out there. So you have a whole lot of dynamics and a whole lot of things you're trying to appeal to. You want to appeal to the fanboys in a comic film, and you want to appeal to people who know nothing about comics, which I just think it's hard to do. And it's very rare that you get like a Captain America 2, which was just an awesome movie. You know, usually those films are like not that well thought out. And Amazing Spider-Man 2, for whatever reason, you know, I think Sony's just trying desperately to like be a small ripple in the big pond that the rock that was Marvel's movies, you know, has caused this ripple. And I think like Sony would do a whole lot better to try to figure out their own thing rather than just try to have their own version of an Avengers movie, which it sounds like they're trying to do. And again, we're already looking three films ahead with them, but I'd like them to tell us the story that they're in now before they got so many Easter eggs for what we might see in the next film, but they're not particularly telling well what's there right now. So
seems like just a symptom of our culture in general that we, you know, we're looking ahead, trying to keep our livelihood afloat, and trying to keep the franchise afloat, and in so doing, damage what's happening now. Like, unable to focus in the now and do well now, you know, make something quality.
Yeah, sure.
Well, no, good.
No, I'm fine. I'm just listening. Go ahead.
Well, I hope that kind of gives a little bit of context to why maybe the sequels don't. I mean, I really like the analogy of, like, you know, they can come up with the concepts for the first movie in these trilogies, these series of movies for a long time, but then having to rush to put the next one out there, you know, maybe not knowing what they're going to do, maybe not knowing exactly how to make it work. Trying to reintroduce characters for people who, for some reason, because there are people who literally probably did not go see The Amazing Spider-Man and came to see The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, you have to make a film that kind of conveys that. So it's a lot harder to make a good superhero sequel, which is, you know, I mean, we saw Iron Man 2 was not as good as Iron Man. It was surprising when, you know, Captain America, the Winter Soldier was an amazing film, because it's not the norm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, from there we'll move to where we get to kind of belittle the movie, but I'm sure we've all hit on some of these already. So, and Rick, we'll start with you. What was your come on moment when you're watching this movie? Yeah, maybe it was a scene, maybe it was a character, just a theme that was throughout. Just anything that, you know, left you unhappy.
Can I just do, like, real quickly several, and then instead of just one?
Okay. Yes, because I'm going to do several.
Okay.
We'll do rapid fire.
I'll try to go really fast. The one thing that's just a personal pet peeve, Harry Osborn, you're not bald, why do you have a comb over? That was one thing. Let's see. Right at the very first start of the movie, you have this James Bond type fight on an airplane with Peter's father, which, again, that's kind of strange for the comics to have, because they just died in a car accident on a drive. Something like that was written in later. But what I thought was funny was, like, they blow a hole in the side of the plane and the guy goes flying out, but the laptop doesn't. You know, and I'm thinking, if this is supposed to be 20 years back or whatever it was, did they have wireless internet, and then wireless internet, especially on airplanes, you know, at that time? Because you're looking back when Peter's a young boy. I don't know how many years exactly, but that was a stretch to me. And I don't mind having to come in with a little bit of disbelief, but I want the film to play by its own rules that it creates, you know. I hated, like, the fake dubstep music when Electro is battling, and it's like, you know, and I was like, what on earth are we supposed to be hearing his thoughts or whatever? So, and then the other thing that the inconsistency of the Spider-Man costume in this film alone. If you look some scenes, he has like this these eyes that look like mirrors where they reflect everything, and then there's other scenes they look like white webs or something that are not reflective at all, and it changes throughout the film depending on the scene. And so again, I just wanted the movie to like play by its own rules that it was making. Again, you can stretch my imagination to believe something that's not reality, but stay consistent with whatever you have. So there's lots more I could go on, but I don't want to take up too much time. But those were a few of the things that I thought were kind of like, yeah, okay, cool, great.
Laura?
let's see. Unfortunately, as I was watching The Amazing Spider-Man 2, there were a lot of places where I was like, wait a minute. And I didn't want to feel that way when I was watching the movie. I just wanted to enjoy the movie. But one of them was, there were two scenes that felt so rushed, and I just was sitting there watching it feeling like, oh, I'm supposed to be getting some plot point that's going to be significant later on. And one of them was when, after passionately kissing her at their graduation, Peter is suddenly at dinner that night like, I can't do this anymore.
Yes, yes.
The other one is when Harry comes in and tells his entire backstory to his father about how he got kicked off to boarding school, just for our convenience.
Thanks, Harry.
And I guess it's because of science that even though Electro is incorporeal, he can still come back wearing clothes.
And he can get, and he can get hit by a car.
Yeah, exactly. But I think one thing that is still kind of bothering me, which is why I think I've just been thinking a lot about the film after seeing it, even days after seeing it, is that I feel like the end about, you know, like Gwen becoming immortal in terms of being with Peter for the rest of his life, like affecting him with her sacrifice and her speech about being hope to people and overcoming your suffering. I feel like all that feels really good, but if you dig very deep into that, I don't know. I just feel this underlying sense of dread that could be true, that's all there is, that we're only going to live on so much as we live on in our legacy, that there's nothing beyond that. Because if you dig really deep into that concept, you know, is that whole speech about like being hope to other people, is that strong enough to keep Peter afloat, like above his grief, like for a long time, or is it just going to be like a temporary effect? You know, like what's really the lasting impact that is going to make him overcome his suffering? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
just,
yeah.
Because yeah. If it's only that, like, oh, I'm just going to do good in life, and that's, you know, that's the lesson to be learned. Well, he was trying to grasp for good things and happiness and joy, and then a few moments later, all his joy shattered. You know?
Well, if you also take it out to its logical conclusion, which means that you apply that to examples that aren't ideal, outside of a well-to-do, high-scale, well-educated, white, you know, lifestyle, who, you know, you have the free time, the choices, and the, you know, basically the options to choose to do good for other people with the majority of your time, like, it doesn't leave a lot of hope for people who are on the margins.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, well, if this is all you really have to offer in life, your life doesn't mean very much.
Mm-hmm.
Because
you're so busy making ends meet that you can't.
Yeah, you don't have time to. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Like, oh, it's little victories, but I mean, like, people who, well, like I said, you know, people who are born with particular disabilities or in unfortunate circumstances that they have no control over, people who have been maligned or imprisoned or embattled all their life due to their circumstances, that really doesn't leave a lot of hope for them.
Yeah.
Especially long term. I mean, because what legacy are you living then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah. This is very much like pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Like, you be hope for people. You do what you can do, you know?
nihilism.
Yeah. So I want to really be on board with that and just feel like my heart is soaring with Peter, like, you know, picking himself back up from from this tragedy and going back into the world. But, you know, how lasting can that really be? Mm-hmm. Anyway, that I think is what is troubling to me, even mm-hmm. after days after seeing the film, that I don't want to be troubling to me, but it is.
Well, it's, yeah, and you know, when you say that, it reminds me of, if we're going to relate this to Christianity, there's only so long that the whole scare tactic works, like, come to Jesus so you won't go to hell, you know? Yeah. Like, that wears off pretty fast, like, because I'm mm-hmm. living in the real world, and honestly, that's a pretty poor reason to be on the journey, you know? There's actually such a richness in life in Christ that if we're only ignoring it, you know, if we're only focused on just, oh, I'm just going to be this way so I can go to heaven when I die, again, like you said, that's not very good motivation to continue this journey, you know? Mm-hmm. There's something got to be deeper to that. So I think that's a very good point you're making.
Well...
Oh, yeah. What's your come on, Mikey? Yeah,
I was going to say, shifting back to me just complaining about things. I'll say things basically that I mentioned already. The villains in this movie, for different reasons. Electro, I thought, was a cool concept. I mean, he even looked amazing at times, but ultimately I thought he was distracting and poorly developed.
Yeah.
As much as I like the concept of the Green Goblin being in this, and we talked about how much we would have preferred this to be about the Green Goblin, it wasn't. Yeah. So because it wasn't, he basically seemed like an afterthought, just only thrown in to, you know, do the ultimate plot twist at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, you know, like I said, I think is necessary for Peter to develop, unfortunately. I think Gwen living does not help Peter grow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even though it is often used as a very crappy way to develop characters or to create character development, I think, you know, this is one of those times where I don't mind it so much. But, you know, honestly, I mean, not to skip to the favorite moments, but I thought the Rhino was the only bad guy that I thought made any sense at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other big thing that stuck out to me was the entire mystery, and we, you know, we hit on this before, the mystery of Peter's parents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like you said, the whole movie started with this James Bond like thing that hadn't, like, basically did not bring anything to the story at all.
Yeah,
like, we're probably going to look back in a movie or two and realize that brings a lot to, like, the Sinister Six movie. You know,
yeah.
That it didn't seem to really do a lot for Peter as a character in his development, not near as much as almost everything else in the movie did.
Mm.
It just could have been skipped. And I don't understand why this movie didn't start out like it basically skipped to secondly,
mm-hmm.
which was start this movie out with Gwen's speech and this awesome, what I thought was truly amazing Spider-Man chasing the bad guys scene, you know, balancing, you know, showing us from the very start of the movie, you know, his balance between Spider-Man and Peter Parker.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And showing Spider-Man being fun, being, you know, clever, being quirky, being kind of a smart ass to, you know, the bad guy, even in the face of danger.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was awesome, and I don't understand why they didn't start the movie that way.
Yeah.
Because I think that sets the tone for everything that happens afterwards.
Yeah.
So those are kind of some of my moments that just really stuck out like sore thumbs.
Yeah, for sure.
But we changed our tune now to what we like the most. What was your favorite moments, Rick?
You know what? You're going to probably think this is crazy, and probably all the listeners will, and I've even, like, read some reviews that thought this was the weakest part of the film, and I don't know if it's because I'm a new father or what, but honestly, the very last scene of the film where that little boy comes out in the Spider-Man suit and mm-hmm. he stands up in front of Rhino, to me, that encapsulates the character of Spider-Man better than Andrew Garfield has in two films, because one thing I know from being a longtime Spider-Man reader is the whole spirit of the character is, even if I know there's no way I'm going to win this, I'm going to step up, do the right thing, and not give up, even if I die. And somehow, there was something so powerful to me. Like, you'll think this is dumb, maybe, and it's okay. Anybody listening, you can make fun of me. But I got a little teary when that kid stepped out there and just kind of stood before the monster. It was almost this David Goliath type thing. Mm-hmm. And this kid, I mean, I don't know if he was so touched and so influenced by Spider-Man, who had taken time for him, that he so wanted to be heroic and so wanted to help. You know, like only little kids can, they have imagination, you know, thinking they can do what they can't. But I don't know, for me it was just something. I immediately had this vision of the weak overcoming the strong. And even as dumb as Paul Giamatti's character, as he was playing him as the Rhino, and I love Paul Giamatti, I can't wait to see him in the next film, but but obviously he's kind of playing the character as this big dumb brute that doesn't really have a lot of thought other than destruction and, you know, get what I want. Even he kind of stops in his tracks, you know, and the police, the crowds, everybody are like standing back, and he starts kind of taunting the kid, and the kid just kind of stands there, and he's like puts on his mask. And and I don't know, probably that's not what the movie producers want to hear, that this simple scene with a little kid was the best part of the film. But for me, I don't know why, but again, maybe just because I'm a new father, but it really spoke to me, like, about the idea of just the weak overcoming the strong, so to speak. And even the way that when Andrew Garfield, Peter Parker, comes back on the scene, or Spider-Man, and he's like, "Hey, Spider-Man, why don't you let me handle this one?" But that, like, that scene and the way he treats people he rescues, which ultimately is why Jamie Foxx's character becomes so obsessed with him, he seems to make people feel important, you know. And I like that about the character, and he obviously made this kid feel important enough that this kid wanted to do something to help all these people, even though he couldn't, you know. So all right, so that was my favorite point.
Well, I was gonna say, I don't think there's any problems with that at all. Actually, even though it's not my favorite part of the movie, the thing that I loved about that scene was that, having gone back and watched Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2, both of those movies have parts in them where, like, the city stands up for Spider-Man to show you that, like, Spider-Man, he is a symbol of hope. Mm-hmm. He is inspiring people. And I felt like both the times that kind of happens in Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2, it didn't really fully do it for me. Even though, like, maybe at the time it did, but looking back, it didn't. Not compared to the fact that that kid walks out there and is completely inspired by Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. I thought that did more to show that, like, Spider-Man was needed as a symbol, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Right. Than for his superpowers. Better than the originals did.
Sure. I agree totally.
Hmm. Laura?
One of the scenes that stands out to me the most is the one between Peter and Aunt May, when he is begging her to tell him what she knows about his father. I just think that Sally Field does a great job in that scene, and as I think about it, it makes me realize that Peter actually has a lot of heroes in his own life who shape his concept of heroism. I mean, there's Uncle Ben, there's Gwen, there's even Gwen's father to some degree, just some people who have been influential in his life and who have shown him what sacrifice looks like. And I mean, Aunt May has, you know, also dealt with trying to overcome grief and loss, and she's been a really strong figure despite what she's lost. And just that part where she says, "You're my boy," you know, she's poured so much into him, and she considers him her son, and she's, you know, she's facing losing him too to adulthood or to ghosts of his father. I don't know. I just thought it was a powerful connection between this mother and pseudo son, and I thought it was a sweet moment of just showing her character, her strength of character.
Cool. Yeah, I definitely could have probably used a little more Aunt May.
Yeah.
I felt like in the first trilogy we got a lot of Aunt May, mm-hmm. and I don't really think that she was necessarily my favorite part. But I feel like Sally Field's done a really good job as Aunt May, and we get very little of her.
Well, Peter's still pretty much a kid, you know, and she's mm-hmm. really his only guiding light.
Yeah.
That's teaching him.
That's alive.
Yeah, that's alive. That's teaching him how to live and how to juggle life. And anyway.
Yeah. Well, my favorite moments, like I said, mostly I've already kind of hit on. I love the interpretation of Spider-Man when he's in the costume. Not only in Amazing Spider-Man 2, but in the Amazing Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
I just way prefer it. I way prefer Garfield to Tobey Maguire.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's like always a preference thing, but I just like his kind of unnecessarily cocky confidence,
mm-hmm.
even though he has really no reason to be until he gets powers. And then it just kind of, he doesn't let it overtake him. But I like that version of Spider-Man a lot better. Probably the thing that stuck with me most about this particular film was that I thought Gwen was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in the way that Emma Stone played her, but in the way that she was developed and created. She's always running towards danger. She has substance.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Gwen and Peter actually have chemistry, you know, like I said, it makes that last thing have weight.
Mm-hmm.
That loss at the end have weight. And speaking of the loss at the end, I think my cheesy favorite thing is I felt like I shouldn't even like this, but when it's in slow motion and I realized when it was in slow motion, when Gwen's falling, that they were actually going to kill her.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the slow motion spider web that basically kind of turns into a hand almost, and it's mm-hmm. reaching out for her. It's just, I thought it was a great picture of, you know, an extension of Peter reaching out for something that he's so afraid that he's going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I felt like it was almost cheesy and you almost shouldn't have had it in there, but it totally worked for me the first time I saw it. And who knows upon subsequent viewings, but I like that imagery.
Sure. No, that's fair. Yeah.
So, well, that more or less wraps us up as far as the movie goes. But as usual, because they have taken time out of their oh-so-busy schedules to join me, I love to give people a chance to let you, the listeners, know how you can follow them or get a hold of them or see the work that they're doing. So, Rick, if people want to follow your work or follow you or just see some of the things that you've been involved in, where can they go? How can they do that?
The easiest way is my website, which is just rickleejames.com. Or you can also follow me. My author/artist page on Facebook is facebook.com/rickleejames. I have a podcast that I host almost weekly. There's a few weeks every now and then I don't quite get it out, being a busy guy, but almost every week my podcast is called Voices in My Head, and you can
the Green Goblin podcast.
That's right. And the reason I call it Voices in My Head is because I kind of cover whatever is has caught my attention that week. And so I have I am a musician. I'm a professional singer songwriter. I've got a few songs that have been published with like Lifeway Worship and things like that. I'm a worship pastor. I travel. So, and I'm also an author. I have a new book out called Out of the Depths, A Songwriter's Journey Through the Psalms, which I will be teaching a class on at Tribeca Nazarene University this fall. So I'm really excited about that. So if anybody wants to get my book or anything, just go to rickleejames.com. If you listen to podcasts, I have guests on nearly every week, musical artists like Andrew Peterson, Jason Gray, Michael Card, All Sons and Daughters, whose new album just came out this week at the time of recording. I have authors on. I have people who are comic book geeks and people like that from time to time. Matter of fact, my friend Ben DeBono of the Sci-Fi Christian podcast, we just got back from Chicago. We were at C2E2, one of the biggest comic conventions in the U.S., and we actually did a podcast together that's sort of a crossover between the Sci-Fi Christian podcast and Voices of My Head, which is going to be airing this week. I say this week, probably by the time you publish this, it'll have been out for a few days.
It probably will have.
But all that is to say, just go to rickleejames.com and you'll be able to find a whole lot of information about me. And so I'll leave it at that, I guess. Thank you very much for giving me time to share that.
Thanks for being here. And like I said, I know Rick threw a lot of stuff out there, but I'll make sure that I get all those links from him so that all that stuff you can find in our show notes, as well as anything that Laura Fissel has.
I just liked Rick Lee James on Facebook.
Awesome.
He's doing that right now.
Hey, one person at a time. That's how we do it.
So. I can be found on Twitter at Laura_Fissel. I write this down this time so I can remember all my handles. You can follow me on Instagram at lfissel. And I have a blog that I try to post on weekly called leavingteaching.wordpress.com. And I'm going to promote something new this time.
Uh-oh.
I'm on a very small board of directors for a local organization called 24/7 Greensboro. And right now, while we're not funded, we're a very small organization, we try to put on 2 events a year in our local area in which we pray for 7 days, 24/7. And our website is 247greensboro.org. And you can see pictures of what the room looks like. It's probably not what you expect when you hear about praying nonstop for 7 days. It's a creative, multi-sensory space. You should like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. All that information can be found on our website.
Great. Awesome.
Uh-huh.
Good job.
Good stuff.
Well, like I said, thanks, guys and girls, women, ladies, beautiful people. so much for joining us this episode. If you want to keep the discussion going, then please follow at Real World Theo on Twitter. Or if you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, then visit our website, realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. Connect with us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you enjoy it, review the show, leave us some feedback, tell your friends, and let's get more people involved in the conversation. On that note, I want to send a big thank you out to J.R. Foresteros and the Drizzle Hizzle for giving us 5-star reviews on iTunes.
Nice.
They both had some incredibly kind things to say about the show, so thank you very much. Again, I just want to thank my guests for being here.
Yes.
Thanks.
I
wanted to thank the listeners for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, just remember that story is powerful. Entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.